Just as we were leaving the house this morning, a television program was coming on. The movie called The Robe, one of several classic movies of the last 50 to 75 years made about Jesus or things having to do with Jesus. And of course, in those movies, just like in most of the paintings and pictures that appear in our children's storybooks and classical paintings of Jesus, we have Jesus with the long, thin face, the beard, the long hair. And we decided some time ago to start a series of lessons on portraits of Jesus. Not because we know what he looked like, even though these movies often picture him in a certain way, but rather because the scriptures paint for us certain pictures of who Jesus was, while telling us practically nothing about what he looked like. I suppose our culture would be shocked if someone were to make a movie and we found Jesus clean-shaven and with short hair and not looking at all like the classical portraits that we often see of him. I think that's really irrelevant because whether in our mind he looks like those pictures or some other, it's far more important that we know what he was really like. And the portrait we're going to look at today is one of the greatest portraits of Jesus in the Scriptures. In fact, one entire New Testament book is devoted to this portrait of him. But it's a picture we have trouble imagining because we don't have anything really comparable in our culture to compare it with. Whenever we talk about Jesus as being king, we have some idea of what kings are like. Even though our country doesn't have one, certainly there are still nations of the earth that does, and as we studied world history, we read a great deal about those who were kings. And when we read Jesus in other portraits as well, like shepherd, or like last week, the light of the world, all of those are things we can relate to in one way or the other. But I think perhaps the one we talk about today is difficult for us to imagine. When God instituted the law under Moses back in the Old Testament, in the book of Leviticus, in the book of Exodus, one of the things he designated was that there was to be a whole line of people called priests to serve him under that religion. In fact, we're just about to begin in less than 2 weeks on Thursday night a study of what's called the sacrificial system. Essentially a study of the book of Leviticus on Thursday night in the Tanglewood Bible Institute. It's a study that is highly profitable for us to understand both about the priesthood and the sacrifices that they made and how those relate to us, even though they were not for us. Instead, the scriptures tell us whatever those things were that were written beforehand were written for our understanding. And today we're going to talk about Jesus as our great high priest. A priest was one that God had designated to stand between God and man. That was a special role that the priest in the Old Testament had. On the one hand, they represented God and God's grace and God's mercy, as well as God's justice and severity. And so they were charged with a responsibility of maintaining the law that God had given and seeing that those who broke God's law were punished and to see that those who were penitent when they had broken God's law could be forgiven by God's grace. They also taught God's law. They were the teachers of the law originally. At the same time as they represented God toward their fellow man, they then would turn around and represent man toward God. For they were the ones who made the sacrifices that the penitent ones brought in order to obtain forgiveness. And the high priest, especially, who oversaw this entire daily regimen of sacrifices and offerings and worship and observation of days and practices and so forth, he was the one who once a year uniquely was appointed to go into the most holy place in their tabernacle originally, then later their temple, and to appear before the mercy seat of God in that most holy place, and to pour out the blood of the sacrifice, first for his own sins, and then for the sins of the people. See, he represented man before God. He was a man. He was like them. He had sinned like them. He knew what it was like to fall short of God's perfect law. And so he first of all would have to actually offer sacrifice for his own sin, and then he could offer sacrifice for the sins of all the people. And he was designated as the high priest. Now, unfortunately, the priesthood that we read about in Exodus and Leviticus did not get off to a great start. Sometimes in novels and other stories, we will read this little line that we know what it means. It says, "This did not bode well." And what that meant is that whatever's happening here doesn't promise better things for the future. And when God had designated the brother of Moses as the first high priest to represent God to the people and to represent the people before God, things did not get off to a good start. Because it was Aaron, the high priest, who actually led the people away from God in overseeing the building of a golden calf and the worship of an idol by the people instead of the worship of God. Yes, he was put in a tight place. Yes, he felt threatened by the people. He made the excuse that the people made me do it. And yet, we see clearly from the very beginning, this priesthood and this priest was a very fallible, flawed person. And it did not get better. It was among his sons and near relatives that Nadab and Abihu arose, who were to be offering sacrifices and service to God, and offered the what was called the strange fire, and God struck them down. It was another one of Aaron's sons who sinned against God and was removed entirely from the priesthood. And the lineage passed from him to another one of Aaron's sons. And while there were many good men who served in that role and took their role as priest of God very seriously, nevertheless, there were many flaws in that system. And we get down to the New Testament times, when Jesus comes, we see a priesthood that really are dictators over all the rest of the people. They've taken advantage of their position and their role to actually become the rulers over the people. And they were of a certain religious group that were called the Sadducees, which sadly, many of them didn't even believe in what they were doing. It had become a traditional role generation after generation. It's the way they and their families made a living and they provided for themselves. And so they continued to do this, some of them, when they didn't even believe it. It wasn't true of all of them, but it was true of some. And many of them, like the high priest himself, it seems, Caiaphas and Annas, the two we read about in the New Testament, who were driven more by power and by money than they were by conviction and by the importance of the role that they actually had. It was so bad that by Jesus' time, there were some people who had actually withdrawn from the Jewish religion that was being practiced up in Jerusalem and had withdrawn out into the desert in an area near the Dead Sea, which the remains of have been discovered in recent times, and is called Qumran, and the place where the Dead Sea Scrolls were. And the people that had withdrawn out there believed that the priesthood was so corrupt that it could no longer represent God to the people, or the people to God. And so they had completely withdrawn from the Jewish religion that we see in New Testament times. And so it was a system appointed by God with the most important responsibilities, and yet seriously flawed and often a failure. Not because of God's failure, but because of man's. And when we get to the New Testament, we see Jesus. Now, when we see Jesus in his days on earth, what do we see him as? We see him as the prophet of God, a spokesman for God. We see him as the king who was to come. We see Him as the Son of God, and yet we really don't see Him as the priest of God. Instead, we see Him as the counterpart to the priest of God, as John the Baptist said, pointing to Him while speaking to His disciples, He says, "Behold, the Lamb of God." In other words, there's the sacrifice of God. And so while His days on earth, we see Him in all of these pictures, but it's not until after He has left this earth we suddenly start understanding Him as the priest of God. Now, it was predicted in the prophecies in the Old Testament that someone was going to come who was going to be a priest. There's first of all the prophecies that talked about how that He would, this one who was coming, would be a priest forever along the line or after the order of Melchizedek. And that was always a great puzzle to the people of God who read that, because we meet Melchizedek in the Old Testament, a man who was not even a Jewish man, who lived in the city of Jerusalem in the days of Abraham. And we're told concerning him that he was the king of Salem, the old name for Jerusalem, but he was also priest of the God Most High. And he was one that Abraham himself had even given gifts to and given sacrifices to make on his behalf to God, which indicated that Abraham acknowledged him as a priest of God before God had even set up the priesthood of Aaron. And then there were those other statements in the Scriptures, one in which God said in a prophecy that the one who is to come will be both priest and king. And then a promise in the book of Zechariah, one of the prophets, in which God said to the high priest at that time by the name of Joshua, He said to Joshua, "Joshua, you and the men who serve with you are symbolic of the one who is to come." In other words, someone is going to come who's going to be like Joshua the high priest. When we start reading our New Testament, we read Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, Acts, Romans, 1 Corinthians, 2 Corinthians, and we keep reading through our New Testament, and we never find Jesus mentioned in terms of being a priest. It's not until we get to the book of Hebrews that we find Him in that role. And so when we turn together to the book of Hebrews, we learn about Jesus as high priest. Here's our picture for today. When the book of Hebrews begins, the first few verses, the writer of Hebrews wants his readers to understand that Jesus is greater than the prophets who had lived in the Old Testament. That's why he begins as he does. "God, who at sundry times and in divers manners spake unto the fathers by the prophets, hath in these last days spoken to us by His Son, whom He hath appointed heir of all things, by whom also He's made the world." So he starts out by saying Jesus is greater than the prophets because He's God's own Son. He is the heir of everything. He is the one by whom God made everything. All the prophets were servants of God. Jesus is the Son of God. Then as he continues in chapter 1, he lays out the fact that Jesus is greater than the angels. What the writer of Hebrews is doing is taking all those groups of individuals in the Old Testament that the Jewish people looked to as being representatives from God, and pointing out that Jesus is greater than each of them. First the prophets, and now the angels. Certainly the Jewish people would say, well, the law we received from Moses is the most important thing because it came by way of angels. The angels delivered it from God to Moses. And then the Hebrew writer spends most of the rest of chapter 1 quoting Old Testament passages that show that the one who was going to come was greater than the angels. And therefore, when he starts chapter 2, he can say, "We must pay the most careful attention, therefore, to what we have heard." The thing they had heard was the gospel, the news about Jesus. So he says, "We must pay the most careful attention, therefore, to what we have heard, so that we do not let it pass us by or drift away. For of the message that was spoken by angels, that would be the law of Moses, was binding, and every violation and disobedience received its just punishment. How shall we escape if we ignore such a great salvation? He's saying what we have received, what they had received in Jesus, was far greater than what had been received back at Mount Sinai from Moses through angels. But he says this is even greater than that. This salvation was first announced by the Lord, that would be Jesus, and was confirmed to us by those who heard Him. God testified to it by signs, wonders, and various miracles and gifts of the Holy Spirit distributed according to His will. What's He saying here is that what has now been delivered is far greater than what was given at Sinai. And then He will go on from there to point out that this one, Jesus, came and partook of our humanity. Now He's setting us up. I'm giving you some insight into the book of Hebrews. He's setting His readers up for what He's going to talk about in the rest of the book, by pointing out that this Son of God, who was greater than the angels, greater than the prophets, and what He came and delivered was far greater than what was delivered at Sinai. He points out that this one came and became a man. He became one of us. And He points out how that fulfills Scripture. That's what the prophecies had said He would do. And He became one with us. Not just became one of us, but He became one with us. And He did this so that He might eventually set us free from death. Something the prophets couldn't do, something the angels couldn't do, something Moses couldn't do. Only He could do it. And He came and became one of us and one with us so that when He died, He could rise from the dead and demonstrate His power and victory over death and give us a hope that no one who lived before ever had, the resurrection of the dead. And so when He starts chapter 3, this is sort of our keynote verse for this lesson today. So when He starts chapter 3, verse 1, He says, "Therefore, holy brothers who share in the heavenly calling, fix your thoughts on Jesus, the apostle and high priest whom we confess." It's at this point that He calls on His readers now to fix their eyes on who He's about to talk about, Jesus. He's already fixed their eyes on Jesus as an apostle. Now to us, we tend to think of the apostles as Peter, James, and John, the 12 that Jesus appointed. But He's using the word apostle here in its real meaning, which meant a representative and spokesman for someone. That's what apostle really meant, is a diplomat, a representative and a spokesman. And He's already pointed out that Jesus is that. He was a prophet. He was a messenger greater than the angels. He was even greater than Moses, the messenger of God. But He now introduces this new thought, the apostle and high priest. And that's what He'll devote most of the rest of the book of Hebrews to talking about, is how Jesus is our high priest. That's the theme. That's the purpose of the book of Hebrews. And the book of Hebrews does for us what no other book in our New Testament does. Romans, which is often referred to by some, at least, as the constitution of the gospel, in other words, the very foundation in which all the gospel is explained, never mentions Jesus as priest. Galatians, which talks about the fact that we cannot be saved by works of law, by what we do, but can only be saved by the grace of God, never mentions Jesus as priest. It's not because Paul was unaware of that service that Jesus rendered, but because he was focusing first and foremost in both of those books on what happened at the cross, instead of what happened immediately afterwards. It's only in the book of Hebrews that we find him pictured in fulfillment of those Old Testament prophecies. And so in the book, from this point forward, he will be showing how Jesus was a better priest than what the Jews had ever had before, and that what he offered was a better sacrifice than what had been offered before. Because all they had was the sacrifice of animals, the bloods of bulls and goats to offer for their sins. Something, of course, that God had designated that they could use as a substitute for giving their own lives for sin. But Jesus didn't come to offer the blood of bulls and goats. He shed His own blood. The Son of God died and gave His life as a sacrifice. It was a better sacrifice than what they had ever had offered before. And He did this as He served in a better temple. The writer of Hebrews will point out to his readers and to us that the tabernacle in the Old Testament, and then later when that was replaced with the temple, was made according to a plan. And that plan was for it to in some way be a representation, a copy of what's up in heaven. And while their priest in the Old Testament offered their sacrifices at a copy, the great high priest offered his sacrifice in the real place, in heaven itself, the real temple of God, not just a copy of it. And he did this as part of a better covenant. And so a key word in the book of Hebrews is the word better. Better priest, better sacrifice, better temple, better covenant. In other words, a relationship, sort of a covenant, the way they used it, didn't mean just an agreement. Today in our legal system, a covenant is an agreement between two people based on certain agreed upon things. In their system, a covenant was something which one side dictated and the other side agreed to. It's slightly different. And in the Old Testament, they had a covenant. God dictated the terms at Sinai, and they agreed to it. But now God has dictated a new covenant, a better covenant. And those who have responded to the gospel have agreed to that covenant and entered into that agreement. There's a better covenant now, and a better hope. A better hope. So let's look for a few moments at what Hebrews tells us about the priesthood of Jesus. This certainly is worthy, in my opinion, of a whole series of lessons that we could deliver on this. And I at one point even thought I would do that, but decided it just didn't fit in with what I'm doing right now. So we just devote this one time for the moment to this portrait of Jesus as high priest. Certainly they knew from their background, the Hebrews, the letter of the Hebrews is written to Jewish Christians. That's why it's called Hebrews. They're people who once knew and had participated in what went on up there at that temple in Jerusalem. And they knew about the high priest who had come out in these special robes that had been designated for him in all of its finery and all of its glory and all of its color. And every single part of it was symbolic of something very special. Whether it was the turban on his head or the golden band around his head or the plate that was mounted on the front of him were the 12 stones, each of a different kind, each representing one of the tribes of Israel. Every part of that had a symbolic meaning. So they're fully aware of that, and they knew the great pomp and ceremony, but also the great reverence and awe that was struck in the hearts of everyone as they saw these ceremonies being played out up there at the temple. And he wants them to understand that as awesome as that was, and as important as that was to them, all of it was only a forerunner, a shadowing of what was really going to happen. And he lays that out as we read in the book of Hebrews. The first thing he points out to us is that this new priest we have, Jesus, is not of the tribe of Levi. He is of a different tribe. And this was pointed out in the prophecies of the Old Testament in two ways. First of all, by pointing out that the prophecy was that when he would come, he would be a priest after the order of Melchizedek. Melchizedek, this man of the Old Testament, which we know so little about, and they didn't know any more than we do, was not of the tribe of Levi. He was not of the descendancy of Aaron. He was not an ancestor of Aaron either. He was not even Jewish. So clearly God, the Hebrew writer argues, was trying to tell people even way back then that when the new high priest comes, he will be of a completely different kind than what you've been used to. He will come from a totally unexpected place, and he will serve forever. A word that we often overlook even as we talk about this order of Melchizedek. It says he will serve in this capacity forever. The other prophecies in the Old Testament was that this priest would come from the tribe of Judah. In order for that to happen, either for him to be from Melchizedek in some way or of any other tribe other than the Levite tribe, such as the tribe of Judah, the law would have to change. Not that they would just have to make some change in the law, but the whole law needed to be changed out for that to happen. Because the whole law was premised on the priesthood being from Levi. And so to have a priest come from somewhere else, whether any other tribe or any other place, than from the tribe of Levi would require the whole law to be changed out. And that's what the Hebrew writer is arguing has happened. You remember back in the book of Acts, whenever Stephen, in Acts chapter 6, got into a sharp argument and contention with some of the Jews who were in some of the synagogues in Jerusalem. And the contention became so sharp, and they were unable to answer his arguments. So they finally take him and drag him before the Sanhedrin and argue that he was teaching that the law and the temple was going to be changed. I think what we're hearing is that Stephen was the first one who clearly was preaching that in order for Jesus to be the high priest was require the whole law to be changed out and the whole temple to be changed. For that's what they accused him of teaching, and he didn't deny it. The Hebrew writer is expanding on that by letting us know that this new priest is not going to come from the tribe of Levi, which would have fit in with the law, but rather he's going to come from another place. He's going to be from the tribe of Judah, and he's going to be a priest forever along the order of Melchizedek. Well, the tribe of Judah was the tribe from which kings came. Starting with David, that God established the order that from David, his descendants would be kings. Right down until the day when the one would come who would be a son of David, and then would be designated a king forever. And so in the minds of those who were sharp and could see what the prophecies were saying, they were suddenly saying God was going to bring together the priesthood and the kingship under one person. That's in fact what he did. Jesus is both priest and king. Secondly, not only was it going to require a change of the law because he was going to be a priest forever and from a different tribe than the priest had been before, he was going to be the priest that received his priesthood by the oath of God. And so we'll read here in Hebrews in chapter 7. And starting in verse 15, he's in the middle of this discussion about him being a priest after the order of Melchizedek. And he says in 7:15, "And what we have said is even more clear if another priest like Melchizedek appears, one who has become a priest not on the basis of a regulation as to his ancestry, but on the basis of the power of an indestructible life. For it is declared, you are a priest forever in the order of Melchizedek." He says priests in the Old Testament were chosen by virtue of the fact that they were descendants of Aaron. That was the regulation that the law laid down. But he says that former regulation is now set aside because it was weak and useless, because the law made nothing complete. And a better hope is introduced by which we draw near to God. And it was not without an oath. Others became priests without any oath, but he became a priest with an oath when God said to him, "The Lord has sworn and will not change his mind, you are a priest forever." Both the statement about you're a priest forever in the order of Melchizedek and the Lord has sworn that you're a priest forever, both are from Psalm 110, verse 4. So the Hebrew writer is arguing not only is the new priest going to come from a different tribe, but God has sworn with an oath that he will be priest. But God didn't make any oath when he declared that Aaron would be priest or any of his family after him. Only with this priest did he swear with an oath. So Jesus' priesthood is based on an oath by God. And it's an eternal appointment. Aaron grew old and died. So did his sons, grandsons, great-grandsons, great-great-grandsons. And every generation, they grew old and died in their service. And even the very best of them, whether it was Joshua the high priest in the book of Zechariah, or whoever it was, even they grew old and died. So theirs was not an everlasting service. But God has sworn concerning this one that he would be a priest forever. And what do we see in Jesus? One resurrected from the dead who is alive forevermore. And who even now, 2,000 years later, is still in heaven serving as high priest. He's not going to be replaced by another because he lives forever. And he has access to what Aaron and the other priests never had access to, the true Holy of Holies. Aaron and those who came after him, so long as the Ark of the Covenant was in the Holy of Holies in their tabernacle and then later in their temple, that high priest would go in once a year and bow down in front of the Ark of the Covenant, over which was the two cherubim mounted, and the place in between them had been designated as the mercy seat, a representation of the very place where God would sit. But God wasn't there. It only was designated as a representation of that. And an eternal flame actually burned there, one that was not maintained by anything human. But God himself maintained this eternal flame burning there. And that high priest would bow down before that and offer his sacrifice. But Jesus went into heaven itself and bowed down before the throne of God itself, the real mercy seat, where God really is sitting, and made his offering, a far greater high priest. And he was a sinless high priest. All the priests of the old covenant had to make offerings for themselves first, and then for the people. But Jesus did not have to make any offering for himself, for he had never sinned. He was a sympathetic high priest, in that he had come to this earth and become a man. Now we're starting to understand even more of why it was necessary for him to become human, so he could truly be a priest who represented us before God, because he was one of us. He became one of us. And he was fully sympathetic with everything we endure and everything we're tempted by and everything we're subject to and everything we feel, because he also faced all of those things. But the difference is, while we fall short, he did not. But he still is sympathetic with us. And so the scriptures call him a sympathetic high priest. In Hebrews 7:26, such a high priest meets our need, one who is holy, blameless, pure, set apart from sinners, exalted above the heavens. But at the same time, fully cognizant of what we're enduring. And as we've already said, it was a part of a better covenant. In the Old Testament, you became a member of the family of God by being born into it. If your parents were from one of the tribes of Israel, one of the descendants of Abraham, then you were one of the descendants of Abraham and you were automatically Jewish. In the New Covenant, people become a part of the family of God and the people of God based upon being born again by the new birth, in which the old life of sin and being separate from God is cut away and done away with, and we enter into a new relationship with him based upon our faith and his grace and our acceptance of what he's done for us. And it's to a better hope. The hope in the Old Testament was, as a Jewish person is, that God would keep you in the land that he had given your ancestors, and that he would protect you from your enemies, and as long as those sacrifices were made on your behalf, that your sins would be pushed away and he would not hold you accountable for them. And you could only look forward to that day one day when a greater one would come and something better would come. Well, now the better has come, because now people have forgiveness of their sins once and for all. And they have hope of eternal life, which they didn't even know about in the Old Testament. And we have what they did not have, and that is expectation of resurrection from the dead. The Jews were greatly divided over whether there was ever going to be even a resurrection. They knew nothing about it. It was all speculation for them. But now we hear from Jesus that we will be raised from the dead. He has the power to do it, and he's promised he will. It's a better covenant, a better hope. Some religious groups today have those they designate as priests. Some even that claim to be Christian groups have them. They're not the priests the Bible talks about. Man has gone too far and substituting something of man for the things of God. We need no other priest except the great high priest we have, Jesus. And then he has designated us as a holy priesthood, every single believer. We're all in service at the temple of God. But only one makes the sacrifice for sin, and he's already made it one time for all time, and that's Jesus. And he's the one who now is in heaven, in the Holy of Holies, standing before God on our behalf, interceding, mediating for us. This is a portrait of Jesus found in the book of Hebrews.